The Team Never Quit podcast is sponsored by Navy Federal Credit Union. Navy Federal Credit Union helps you take control of your finances after the holidays. Learn more at NavyFederal.org.
Team Never Quit Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
All right, so kick it off.
We're here. All right, over there now.
Yeah, we're getting all of our. We got two new wizards sitting behind the hot desk now. We got Aaron Kendall joining us, and my lovely sister-in-law Melanie is handling all the acoustics and all the digital sound systems because Andrew and John are out today, so it should be entertaining.
They're on vacation.
They're taking a Christmas vacation, but we won't do our stereotypical introduction because I don't have it in front of me to read. So we're just going to jump right into it. But today we are blessed
and honored.
To have an American hero.
Well, I feel the same.
From the greatest generation.
Yeah, right.
Because we know there's not that many of them
standing Plus, you have over 100 years on this planet.
Beg your pardon?
You have over 100 years of life on this planet. You're fixing to be 101, right?
Yes, sir.
So we have with us retired Major Joe Balo, U.S. Army Air Corps, and fought for our country in World War II, and he is a extremely young 100 years old right now, fixing to turn 101 in March. And we got a lot to get into.
Yeah, so thanks for coming
on.
Because
he's in the studio with us.
Right. Yeah. So thanks for coming on and talking to us for a bit. I can't wait to hear it.
So let's kick it off, sir. What we normally like to do is kind of get a little background on who you are and where you came from, then get into the stories of your generation while you were fighting the war, because we all know that your generation they take that with them. They don't get to share that much, but since we've been in here sharing stories, we appreciate that too. I think that's a mutual respect, military to military, which, you know,
yes, sir,
we hold you in the highest regards. But let's kick this off, Joe. Tell us a little bit about yourself and where you were born and how you was raised.
I was born in Detroit, actually, and mother and dad had me in the western part of Detroit. But when I became 1 year old, my dad was a bad alcoholic, okay? And mom decided she needs to send me out to the farm to my grandmother and grandfather. And I grew up with my grandmother and grandfather, and I lived with them till I came into service, of course. What I did, I was the only farm boy. I grew up on a farm, of course, with them. But I was the only farm boy that went to high school in that area. In those days, you didn't have to go to high school. It wasn't compulsory. And what I did, I kind of struggled through high school because I didn't have no leadership in because I couldn't even talk English when I started school. I had a fantastic lady, Mrs. Emerson, my teacher, would help me learn English by talking to another girl that was Hungarian that was already talking English. And they translated back and forth, and that's how I learned.
So your mom and daddy spoke Hungarian?
Yes. Well, my mother went to high school. She went to ninth grade before she married.
Where were your parents born?
My dad was also born in Hungary.
So both mama and daddy are from Hungary?
Oh, yeah.
Or Hungarian? Yeah. Sorry.
My mother was 2 years old when she came over, and dad was 12. And what I did, I was fortunate that I, for some reason, I wanted to go to high school, and I had to walk 7 miles. The farmhouse was 7 miles from Flat Rock, Michigan, where high school was. But when I was walking, a gentleman named Joe Bader was working at a little Ford subplant in Flat Rock, Michigan, about a half a mile from the high school, and he drove by our house. He lived further out than we did. And he saw me walking. He stopped. He says, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm going to high school." He said, "You're walking?" I said, "Yes, sir." And he picked me up. He said, "You don't have to walk no more." He carried me through high school for 4 years, the gentleman did. And I owe him a lot. And then when I graduated from there, I went to work at the Ford plant right there. And oddly enough, what happened, I don't know how to say this, but luck has been with me all along in my life somehow.
You say as much, that's a real thing. You can say as much as you want.
And the Lord's been on your side for sure. Yeah,
anyhow, I decided I couldn't go to college, so I went to work for Ford Motor Company, and I knew the girl. I graduated with the girl that was not the president, but the superintendent of the small sub plant. But one day when I'm working on a punch press, I went to get a job, and he hired me right away because he knew about me. And then what I did, I worked at a punch press, putting out dome lights, okay? And I'm punching these things out, you know, forming them. And all of a sudden, a man gets behind me. And I didn't realize he got there. Where he came from, I don't know. But I happened to glance over. When I glance over, it's old man Ford.
Hey, Daddy, really?
Yes, sir. And he just stood there. And boy, I thought to myself, Joe, don't make a doggone error. So I'm punching away, and pretty soon he taps me on the shoulder and says, "Shut your machine down." I thought, what did I do wrong? He asked me, "Do you like your job?" I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "Did you graduate from high school?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Are you going to go to college?" I said, "Mr. Ford, I can't go to college. I don't have no money." He says, "Well, we'll see about that." So he says to me, he says, "How would you like to go into River Rouge, into Detroit, into the motor building, and work on motors?" I said, "I'd love it." He said, "Okay, we'll take care of that. But," he says, "under one condition. I'm going to pay you for 8 hours, and you're going to work six, and you're going to University of Michigan." He took the bill.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Get out.
That's a great story.
Mm-hmm. Henry Ford paid for you to go to Michigan?
Yes, sir. And then he pulled me out of there and took me in the Greenfield Village to take apart the tri-motor, 13 of us, actually 14 because one, the 14th one came on board. 14 of us took that tri-motor apart and put it back together so we'd know how to build an airplane. Then he sent us out to Willow Run. The Willow Run plant was just partially built. They were only building the center wing for the B-24. And he trained us how to put an airplane together. And we built the first center wing on his production line, or the starting of his production line. And what we did, we just got, as we grew, we got on top of each other, you know, all crowded because we're trying to do jobs on the doggone center wing. And so what we did, I went into Nida as a superintendent, and I told Mr. Nida, I said, "Mr. Nida, we're having problems." I said, "We're on top of each other. We're not going to get production that Ford wants." By this time, the fuselage was being built further, and they take the center wing on a B-24 and pick it up, put it right on top of the fuselage, is what they do. Well, Mr. Nida said, "Well, what would you do, Joe?" I says, "Well, I don't really know, but I suggest what we tried to do is take the engine mounts and the landing gear mounts and build them in a separate area, away from all these people working on the wing and putting all the popping all the rivets." He said, "Well, that's a pretty good idea." And he said, "I'll talk to engineering." And sure enough, engineering said that that'd be a good idea. And they set the plan up. They made me foreman. I was 20 years old. Well, as time involved itself, we got the B-24. That first B-24 that we put together, okay, because we did most of it by hand. It wasn't pre-punched by punch presses. And the pilots took it off, got it about 4 feet in the air, and put it back down and never flew it again. I mean, we had so many patches on it, it wasn't even funny. But anyhow, as I worked there, I got more and more interested in aircraft, of course, naturally, because I built airplanes when I was 12 years old, little models. So the war broke out. And then I made my decision that I want to go fly. So I went to Mr. Knight, as plant superintendent. I said, Mr. Knight, I'm going to go ahead and join the Air Corps, and I want to fly. Well, by the time I got home that night, here's this letter from the draft board. 30 days, you're going to the infantry. No, I don't want to go to the infantry. I wasn't good like you guys. I didn't want to be out there in the dirt. Anyhow, I went ahead and went into the federal building and went into the Air Corps and took an a long test, you know, for qualification.
Yeah.
I qualified, and I told him my problem, that I was being drafted. He said, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. So that's where my career started.
So when they were pulling y'all in, when the draft was going on, if you decided you wanted to go and fly, they would just let you do that, right?
Yeah.
You just had to sit down and take a battery of tests, written and physical?
Yes, sir. So when I finally got in, they took me down to Dayton, Ohio, where the Air Corps was at that time, big base. And I was there we were marching more than anything else. And then they sent me out to Ogden, Utah, and I waited out there in Ogden, Utah. I had to wait for 6 months because the Air Corps, the cadets were jammed. You know, we had a lot of cadets in training, and we were full because that was the starting of the war. We didn't lose a bunch of men. So anyhow, I stayed out there at Ogden, Utah, and got on a B-17 because I was able to, because I was helping build a B-24. They made me a crew chief on the B-17. I rode that with Lieutenant Eels. And I told him my problem, that, you know, I've got to wait. Now I want to be a cadet. Well, good luck again. He told me just exactly how to do it, how to get in. Because you're going to have to take another test. He said, I'm going to tell you the books to get. And he started training me on some of the questions that they asked. So when I took my second test, when they finally called me in because they had an opening, they tested me again. And I went with flying colors, and I was lucky. I had the knowledge from Lieutenant Neal's.
Yeah.
And then I started into Santa Ana, California, and we did we didn't do aerodynamics, we did
aeronautics.
Anyhow, we learned all about the aircraft, you know, what makes it fly, how it lifts, and all that stuff. Aerodynamics, that's what I'm trying to say. Anyhow, we took that and took celestial navigation and all that stuff. And then finally into our first phase of flying in Tulare, California, which was a PT-13A, little acrobatic ship, the two-winger. Man, that was a joy to fly. And I had a Mexican guy instructing me. And he took me up. We even did outside loops in that thing. I mean, you do an inside loop, but we did outside loops, which wasn't supposed to happen. But we...
So the first time you ever went flying was when? When you got in the plane, you took off by yourself. What was that like?
All right, let me go.
That's a different kind of flying back then.
Okay, hold on. I'll get it straight in my mind just a minute. That would be 43. It would have been about February of 43 is what it would have been.
I can't believe
that. That was my first flight, yeah.
What was that like?
Then I went to the second flight phase, which is Vulti Vibrator, which we didn't like. And then the final phase, I flew single-engine AT-6s. They're North American AT-6, which was a training plane for fighter pilots. And then from there, they sent me to another school. Why, I don't know. But they sent me to Douglas, and I started flying instruments. They started training me in instrument flying. They'd put a canopy on you, and you couldn't see out, and you had to find your way. He'd take you out nowhere, and then you had to find your way to the base and get on the final approach before he'd uncover you. But finally I got everything done. Then they put me in Long Beach and I was in the ferry command for a while. I still didn't go overseas. And I flew everything there. And I got checked out in B-25. I got checked out in a whole pot full of aircraft. Anyhow, the B-17 was a comical checkout, okay? What happened, when on Long Beach there in Signal Hill, the instructor comes out, he says, okay, we're going up in a B-17, teach you how to fly a B-17. I said, okay. So we go out there, and he said, he gets in the pilot seat, and I get in the co-pilot seat. And he said, now you watch all the instruments up on top that I turn on, all the switches, how to start this thing, and et cetera, and warm up the engines. And he went through the whole series. And then we started taxiing out. We took off, went out over the ocean quite a ways, and we came back on the way back in. He says, now you watch everything here, and you, there's a lever for the flaps and stuff and the landing gear, and that's, you're going to have to handle that. And I want you to get acquainted with this ship. So sure enough, we come in to land. He taxis out to the ramp, cuts the engines off, takes out his bookwork, starts writing. And I thought, what's going on here, you know? I mean, did I fail this thing? I didn't do nothing. And I finally couldn't stand it no longer. I says, now, do I get to go up next? He's, no, you're checked out. That was it.
That was it, huh?
God. Yeah.
That might be a little worrisome. I don't know if I can make that one happen.
Yeah, and then from there, they sent me up to Merced, California to instruct cadets. I instructed two classes of cadets in a single engine for fighter pilots. And I thought, well, I'll go overseas for fighter pilot. Well, I get in that big buggy right there that you have the picture of.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I flew. I arrived in India of 44 of June or July, I'm not sure which now. Just got graduated in July. I arrived over there in 44 July and then started flying. And I flew co-pilot for a couple of rounds, and the man that was instructing me had flown 66 missions. And I want to clarify the mission business for you, okay?
Okay.
You know, a lot of people say, you flew 106 missions? Well, they were different. They were not like Europe, okay? I mean, they were like a kind of airline flying, okay? And as we didn't have that much interference up north. The time we had the interference and the shoot downs, like I said, when we dumped for Merrill Marauders, because we'd be close to the Japanese.
Just to give our listeners a little background, can you tell them why you went over to India and over into Nepal and all that kind of stuff over in the Himalayas? Can you tell our listeners why we were forward deployed in that area?
Why we were over there?
Yes, sir.
The reason that we set up, we had three bases. We had Sukhothai, which was ours, 1337 AFBU, and we had Jorhat and we had Chabrol. The three bases were set up there for the purpose of hauling stuff over the Himalayas into China to the 20th Bomber Group. We had 3rd Squadron support to the 20th Bomber Group of 25s and 24s. The 24s were long range and the 25s short range. The reason we had to fly over the hump, we had no other way to get them in, to get stuff into them. We couldn't go through Russia. The dictator wouldn't let us in. We couldn't come across the Arctic. Our aircraft couldn't go across the Arctic that far. And we couldn't come in from the east because that's where the Japanese were.
Right.
So it was the only way into China to bring in bombs and stuff. Now we had B-29s over there too. And we'd carry 500-pound bombs, we'd carry artillery, we'd carry everything. I mean, it didn't make a difference what it was, you know, anything they needed over in the 20th Bomber Group. General Stilwell was trying to build a Lido road at that time to help out, because every second day I would fly across. Towards the end, it was every third day. And because we were flying back and forth, when I arrived in Sukerting, India, we had 116 pilots. We'd fly night and day. And we, what happened to the 116 pilots by the time we got, by the time we finished the war, and I don't, I'm jumping way ahead of me here. I'm not inserting some of the stuff that I did want to tell you.
Yeah, no, we'll go back to that.
Okay. We'll go back to it. Anyhow, by the time we, war ended, okay, we all sat there and waited because we were out in, way out nowhere, you know. So we were the last ones, and they were the last ones for us to be picked up. So we're waiting out there. By that time, we were down to 39 pilots. From the 116, they were out in Flanders Field, you know. Got hit by weather mostly, and some of the zeros did get them. I'd say maybe 15% went down to zeros. The rest were all weather. We call it the aluminum trail.
No, so you were forward deployed, and you.
Oh yes, okay. Now there's 39 of us left, and we waited till November. The war was over in August of 45. We waited till November, and finally got a American airline pilot came in, a commercial pilot came in, the four-engine DC-4, and he came in, and he said, I can only load 36 people. Mm-hmm. Well, Colonel Cassidy from Georgia, who was our base commander, we became friendly. I was the senior pilot on the base. I was 24 years old.
24 years old, senior pilot in the middle of a base out in the middle of nowhere during World War II.
Yeah.
I wouldn't trust most 24-year-olds with a potato gun.
Yep. Anyhow, Colonel Cassidy says to me, he says, Joe, get John Bullock, who was, flew 104 missions, and get B.T. Clark, who also flew 104 missions. He says, bring him in here. I want to talk to you. He said, I'm going to put these 36 men on board this airliner. They're going home. And I want you all to stay back. I'll take my airplane, and I'll fly you to Agra, India tomorrow. We said, okay, no problem. Because we were kind of, we became his favorites somehow. Luck again, okay. Anyhow, this guy takes off, goes to Agra, India, where he had to refuel. Well, the next day, we got the story, of course, how all this took place. The guy lands at Agra, India. They refuel him, and he has to go in and sign a slip out at operations that he's leaving and fuel up. And the operations officer told him, Mister, whatever you do, don't go straight to Karachi, which is a usual route they went, or some of them went when we went for engines and stuff. He says, the vicious storms are developing there. We want you to go up to New Delhi and cut across from there to Karachi. He says, it's a little out of the way, but he says, you'll be safe. The pilot's comment to him, I can still remember it, what the operations officer told us. He says, he told the operations officer, I know how to fly my airplane. I'll take care of it. Hour and a half later, they were all on the mountainside. The entire crew. The guys that finished the Cockeyed War were killed by some idiot that didn't know how to fly mountains. But anyhow, this I carry the rest of my life. It's just, every time I think of it, it's real hard on me.
Oh, sorry, sir.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
No. You're perfectly fine.
Some funny things happened to me over there that might interest you all, okay?
Yes, sir.
I was married. I married a little Texas girl from Amarillo, Texas.
Good for you.
There you go.
Anyhow, she had a real close girlfriend called Myra, and Myra had a cousin, a man, that was had orders to go overseas. So Myron asked my wife to go with her. So my wife went, and she met this man. And she talked to him for a minute, and she said, "Do you know where you're going?" He said, "No, we don't know where we're going." She said, "Well, I'm going to give you a note." This is another hard story for me to tell you. She said, "I'm going to give you a note." And she says, "If you see my husband, give it to him." She gave the name and all. What we did, what the pilots did when you came off a flight, and I came in at 10 o'clock that night off of I would call them flights instead of missions. I mean, we felt like we were just flying flights sometime. Anyhow, when I came in, I went to the line mess, and he served me. This man served me. And the officers had to pay for their meals. So we signed a ticket, and then they gather it up at the end of the month. They just take it out of our pay. Well, when I signed my name, this man looks down at it. I guess he looked at all of them, I don't know. But he looks down at it. He looks at me, looks down. I thought, what the heck is this guy doing? Anyhow, he says to me, he says, "Lieutenant," I was a lieutenant then. He says, "Lieutenant," he says, "do you have a wife in Amarillo named Wanda?" Her name was Wanda. I said, "Yes." He said, "I have a note for you." I mean, for her to do that, have confidence that she'd get that note to me was a miracle.
And he didn't know where he was going.
Yeah. I mean, my God, there's 16 million of us all over creation.
Right?
Yeah.
Spread out everywhere.
It is crazy.
That's really a great story, too.
Yeah. Then the other
love conquers all, right?
Yeah. That was a top story for me. The other good thing that happened, it wasn't good at that time to me, but as I look back upon it, I'm glad I did it. Colonel Cassidy called me in one day, and he said, "Joe, I've got a little mission to do for you to do." And I said, "What is it, Colonel?" He says, "I want you to go down south of Peishan, China, to a small P-40, where the Flying Tigers were flying out of." And he says, "You'll have to take my airplane, which is a C-47. It was a DC-3. He said, "That'll land on a short runway. You can't land the C-46 on that short runway." And he says, "Pick up 26 mirror monitors. We're taking them home. We're bringing them home." He didn't tell me what I was picking them up for. Anyhow, Joe Follett, my co-pilot, and then my radio operator and I hopped in the airplane, and we took off in his airplane. We found the strip, and they gave us the bearing from Peishan, which way to go. And we found the strip, and we landed on a strip, but there was no airplanes on it, of course. The P-40s had pulled out by that time. As a matter of fact, the P-40s turned into the Air Corps. They were no more rogue fighters like they used to be. So I land the aircraft, turn around, and here comes the 26 Mirror Marauders running out of the area. Up into the aircraft, one of them ran up to the front. He said, Lieutenant, take off immediately." By that time, I was a first lieutenant. So I thought, okay. So I gave it the power, and we start running down the runway, and I got it off the ground. And when we got about 300 feet, all H broke out. I mean, they were surrounded. The whole airport was surrounded. And back behind was the Horseshoe Mountain. And the whole airport was surrounded by Japanese. And this was in a colonel's airplane. Fortunately, it was in a colonel's airplane because they had a neoprene tank for him where if ever a bullet went through the tank, the gas would not leak out. It sealed just that quick. And we got hit. We got hit real bad. I mean, bullets all over the place. But we finally got out of there, got back to Sucatine, and the guys were all happy to get, you know, to get the heck out of there. I mean, they were pleased. Anyhow, Colonel comes out. He greets them, and I finally crawl out of the aircraft and come out. He says the first thing he says to me, "Joe, what the hell did you do to my airplane?" Right by the cockpit there, we were tore completely out. I mean, where somebody hit us with some stronger arm fire. But I was pleased to do it after I did it. And Colonel Cassidy wanted to get me a special medal, okay? By this time, I had my flying cross and I had several air medals. And he wrote President Truman. Well, President Truman wrote him back. He says, "We can't give him anything." He says, "He wasn't wounded. We can't make him Medal of Honor." He says, "All we can do is just congratulate him." But when he wrote the letter, when the president wrote the letter, he said, "Tell Captain Joseph A. Bailo that we can't give him the Medal of Honor or anything, but so-and-so." Anyhow, I have the letter. It's on my wall in my bedroom from President Truman. So Colonel Cassidy read it to me, and I says, "Colonel, doesn't he know I'm a first lieutenant?" He says, "What do you mean you're first lieutenant?" I said, "Well, he put captain down there. If he said you're captain, you're captain."
That's right. Yes, okay. Yeah, President, I have it right here. I'll read it out loud. "To you who answered the call of your country and served in its armed forces to bring about the total defeat of the enemy, I extend the heartfelt thanks of a grateful nation. As one of the nation's finest, you undertook the most severe task one can be called upon to perform. Because you demonstrated the fortitude, resourcefulness, and calm judgment necessary to carry out that task, we now look to you for leadership and example in further exalting our military in peace." Signed, Harry Truman, the White House. And it does say captain right there. What's up, Cap? Free Captain America.
Anyhow, the next day we finally got out too, and we flew all across Africa and into Casablanca.
How was that?
Pardon?
How was flying into Casablanca?
Well, it was an easy flight, really. The only thing they warned us is that not to get close to where you boys were.
Right.
Yeah, they told us that if we went down there, they'd cut our doggone throat. So we...
I'm just curious real fast. Flying through the Himalayas, Everest, how many times have you...
Oh, yeah.
How many times you pass Everest?
How many times what?
Mount Everest.
Mount Everest?
Yes, sir.
Mount Everest was... when we started out from Sucatine, we'd fly south, okay? Mount Everest was, let me get myself straight, northeast of us, about 30 miles from our base. It was almost across from Chabwa, between Chabwa and Jorhat. We were 30 miles from Jorhat, and then Chabwa was another 25 or 30 miles. Oh, and what happened to Colonel Cassidy and myself, we were in the officers' club, which was a little old straw hut, okay?
Right, yeah. Still had one now.
Still the officers' club, yeah.
What's up?
Anyhow, we get so many beers a month, you know. So we go in there and sip some beer, and we talk to each other, and we talk, ask each other, you know, where you're from, what have you. And he overheard us that I was from a farm in Michigan, and he was from a farm in Georgia. He's a Georgia tobacco rascal. He chewed tobacco constantly. So anyhow, he got acquainted with me and started talking with me real, you know, about farm and different things and growing up. And I kind of become real friendly with him, and then Hulbert, his adjutant, became friendly with me. So Hulbert used to haul paperwork from Sucatine to Jorhat to Chabwa, you know, between the colonels or the base commanders. And he said to me one day, he says, "Joe, would you like to fly that little L-5? We had an L-5 that wasn't a search ship, but it's an L5. I said, yeah, I'd like to fly it. He said, okay, we're going to give you the paperwork, and you take it over to Chabot. And so I got to fly the L5, the little, like a oversized Piper Cub. But it was fun. And then after that, I always flew the doggone thing in between flights whenever he had something to take over.
How many hours do you have in the air when you came out of there?
When I came home, I had a little over 1,000 hours.
You were telling us earlier that you've been shot down twice?
Twice, yes, sir.
Can you tell our listeners about the one you were telling us about the first time when they knocked you guys down and that guy was coming in and hit it, y'all had to take you out one at a time?
You want me to tell that again?
Yeah, would you, please?
Okay. What happened, we were fortunate to bail out in a farm clearing area because there were some farmers around in through there. And we were right, when we were all of us on the airplane dropped, we were close to the woods, to the big trees. I mean, the southern part of Burma was jungle. And what he did, he came back. By the time we got to the trees and behind the trees, he come back. And then he tried to strafe us. He started hitting the trees around there and shattering things, trying to hit us. And that's when I shot at him with the .45. Like I said, I honest to goodness, I'm not lying to you. I couldn't hit the side of a barn with .45.
So, but it was Japanese fighters that came in and shot you guys down?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah, zero.
Yeah, zero. How many of them, was there a bunch of them? Are they flying? They fly in pairs? They fly by themselves? Or are they flying a squadron?
Explain how that happened. Like they said, coming through the clouds above you?
Very, very seldom that ever they flew in groups over there for some reason. They fly alone. They come up alone. They come up from the south all the time. But they always just came to the borderline of China where the Marauders were, where we'd make the drop, and they'd come after us in. What happened, Marcus asked me a question to answer you. We were concentrating on dropping, okay? We were looking for that drop, where we're going to put this thing, where we're going to drop all this stuff. And then suddenly a flare came up, and we were concentrating on that area and didn't pay no attention. Well, we couldn't see backwards anyhow. If you look at the aircraft, we had no way of seeing backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up from behind us. He must have come around somewhere. And we didn't see him from the side because our total concentration was going to be this drop. We were down to about maybe 11,000 feet roughly. However, we weren't that high off the ground, because the plateau where we were going to drop this stuff was about 5,000 feet higher above sea level. Anyhow, he got us just about the time that I started dropping. I was already dropping down. We probably dropped another 2,000 feet from where we came in. And he got on our tail and got us.
Did he shoot the how did he just take the engines out? How did that work?
He took the engine out on the left side, yeah. He hit the engine on the left side and caught on fire. And when it caught on fire, we had what we call a halo system. And we'd pull a cable. And what we'd do is we'd release the halo out. It was a powder form onto the engine to put it out. But if he cut a gas line, which he must have cut on that one, we couldn't get the fire out.
Okay.
We had the rule in briefing was always this. You got 28 seconds to get out of that airplane if you can't get the flames out. However, that wasn't always true, because sometimes it'd take 3 minutes before that darn plane would explode. But, you know, we were rushing. We were trying to get out.
But it would explode, though? It wouldn't burn out?
Yeah. But we all of us agreed that we heard the plane explode. It exploded somewhere in the air. I mean, the fire finally got to...
The fire runs down the gas line into the tank.
And yeah.
Let me see,
we had no neoprene protection on those tanks. Our gasoline, and we had heavy loads of gasoline, tremendously heavy loads. See, we would not pick up any gasoline in China. They use it for the B-24s and 25s and the fighter aircraft over there and the B-29s. So we never could get gas there. We'd load up to the hilt with gasoline in the wings, and we'd fly into China and come back on the same fuel.
So after after he shut you guys down and y'all jumped out, y'all landed in this
clearing. Yes.
In a clearing.
Yeah. Fortunately.
Fortunately.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's lucky. That's another great lucky story, because that never happened. I've never landed in a clearing, and
we jump over
when we were jumping into a clearing. I still couldn't land in a clearing.
Yeah, that's what I said. I had so cockeyed much luck, really, in going through the war. I mean, I was really lucky. Well, anyhow, I think another funny thing that happened to me is Ann Sheridan.
I'm curious, what does it look like when you're bailing out of that aircraft? How many guys are bailing out?
Oh, yeah, because
you're not just like jumping out of this. I mean, how does that
happen? Right. Great question.
I want to see that picture.
Right, great question.
Because y'all had to jump out the side of the aircraft, right? Not out the back.
Yeah, we have to go to the back door on the side.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Right behind the wing.
No, right behind the wing. Yeah.
Behind the wing.
Right.
But you guys don't go to jump training, do you? So it was kind of like, was that like the first time you'd ever jumped out of an airplane?
We had jump training in California. I'm trying to think of the name of the little town. We jumped off of 30 feet is what we did on a rope. But the rope went through a pulley, and it didn't come down all that fast, but it came down fast enough for us to hit good and hard, taught us how to, you know, crumble our legs and how to roll.
PLF.
Yeah. But that's the only training we had. But boy, when you see, you got to remember this too. And I guess, I don't know if you all had the same parachute, but we had what we call fast falling parachutes. You know, fast fall, so the doggone fighter wouldn't come down.
Right. All of my parachutes fell fast.
All of my parachutes fell fast because I was big and cumbersome. But so that was, you had jumping out of a burning airplane that's about to explode. It's completely different of going out of an airplane when you want to jump.
Yeah.
So how did I explain? What was that like? I mean, explain that intensity. You kicked that door. Here's the thing: as I was always fired up about jumping out of an airplane too, until that door came open. And then you hear that rush. Was the fire coming into the door, or was the fire on the other side?
No, it was on the door side.
Oh, yeah.
And it was going past. But see,
so you had to jump into the fire.
No, the engine fire was out further. The engine was out further on the wing, you know, from the fuselage.
Okay. I don't have any depth perception, so I wouldn't have known that. It'll look like it's right there in the door.
Yeah. Well, you could see the flames. I mean, they were coming back. But truthfully... you could not get me to jump out of an airplane, okay? But I had no problem.
Different story when that sucker's...
Now you're scared. You
right.
Know, which is worse, can't jumping get, out yeah. or staying
stay
in
the thing. Get your ass out.
So did that Zero that shot y'all down come back and try to get you while y'all were under canopy?
Or did he fall the plane?
Well, we were down low enough that we fell down fast.
Okay.
And by the time he made his round... we were already down on the ground. We were running for the trees.
And he strafed you. Well, so were
you
on?
You said you were at 11,000 feet.
Pardon?
What was your altitude when you jumped?
The deck was at 5.
When we hit.
When you jumped, how was your altitude?
I say our altitude because we were heading down. We were about, let's see, 5. We were down around 11, so we were about 6,000 feet high when all that happened. I'd say by the time we jumped out of that aircraft, we had to be down about 4,000 feet.
A nice little hop and pop.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
But we count.
Oh, yeah, we do. Eyes closed, too. Do you have your eyes open? All my jumps, I tell people, were at night jumps because I always had my eyes closed, even in the daytime. I was, man. Loved it. Kendall, man, they're all kind of, they're jump guys, they're air guys.
Now, did your straps leave you blue? In between here and the crotch and on your shoulder.
Nah. Man, you're being nice with that blue statement. That's a different. You talking about that T10 Harley or Charlie harness that you had to strap into?
T10 Bravos, right?
Or Bravos?
You jumped the Bravos?
I got jerked through those risers one time. So,
well, I mean, you guys, was y'all as a static line or did y'all have to pull? You had to pull, right?
Oh, it's free fall.
Yeah, free fall.
Ooh,
that's different. That's different.
Yeah.
Because were y'all flying with the chutes on, or did y'all have to put them on in the plane?
We sat on the chutes. We also had a backpack. We had a machete, and we had more ammunition for the .45, and we had chocolate bars and stuff inside of it. And what do you call it? Food that they were serving in
MRE?
The Army.
Oh, yeah.
K-rations.
K-rations. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But we...
Four Fingers of Death, yeah. Ham Slice.
I will tell you this much about the second.
No. Hold on. No, you don't have to get into it. We know that it bothers you. But so let's finish the first one. So y'all hit the ground and the zero came back to strafe you.
Yes, sir.
And then you said you were shooting at him with your 45 and throwing some pretty harsh language at him.
Oh, some, yeah. Plenty of it, I'll tell you.
But you said you were able to...
Hey, back it up. What was you thinking when you came out of that plane and that chute deployed? I want to know what you're thinking when you're hanging in the air and there goes your bird.
Because it had to be freezing cold, too.
All I kept remembering was count, you know, and pull.
That's true. I did that too a
That's
lot.
That's all I had on my mind. Just pull it because I wanted it open. And you know what's funny?
Could you see? Was it dark?
In that 1-2-3 count, it was a slow count. In that 1-2-3 slow count, when I pulled my ripcord and I looked up and saw when I got that jerk, you know, up and through the crotch and across the shoulder, I looked up and there was a chute flared out. And then when I looked down, I saw the ground coming up.
Yeah.
Man, we were down.
Oh, so you didn't even have a ride. It was out and down.
So you don't even really have time to cinch your straps up. I mean,
we had a lot of men break their legs and stuff.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Is he even worried about the other guys in the plane? Is there a procedure of getting out, or is it just every man for yourself to get out of that airplane?
So what was the procedure of exiting the aircraft? Because you were probably the last one out, right?
Yeah, I was the last one. But what we did, the pushers went out first. We call them pushers.
They're the ones that put the cargo out, right?
Yeah. Okay. They went first, and then the radio operator went next, and then Joe followed the co-pilot and myself.
All right.
I had a great co-pilot. He slept all the time.
Hey.
Oh, well,
that's great.
All right, so when you guys hit the ground, then what? Because that's a different world altogether. Then now you're in the jungle.
Well, now then, we stayed right there. See, it's 4:15 in the afternoon.
Oh, so it was daytime?
Daytime, and it's wintertime. So,
was it sunny, or what was the weather doing? Was it raining?
It's clear.
Right.
But the problem was that we knew they couldn't find us that night. So... We all huddled up inside in our parachute and tried to sleep. We didn't sleep, of course, but the next morning at 8:15, because they found us, the area, we heard this little airplane buzzing around and coming closer and closer. And what we did, we ran out, one of the guys ran out and put the parachute out in the clearing, and he kept going around and finally found us. Then he dropped us a walkie-talkie.
Yeah.
And he dropped a submachine gun, Thompson. And
nice, really? There you go. But
he came in, and you were saying that the plane that came in that could land in that little strip could only take one at a time.
Yeah, he could land in 250 feet. It had extended wings.
That's like from here to my truck.
Yeah, it only flew about 80 miles an hour.
But he came in, he'd pick one up and leave. You said it was about
right.
30 minutes one way or just 30 minutes out and back?
It took about 38 minutes for the round trip.
I remember exactly.
To where he dropped us off.
What, did he radio for people to come, more help to come pick y'all up? Or is he the only one who can get in there and do that?
No, what they did, they took us into Mission Hall. Mission Hall had a strip, a landing strip. And they contacted one of the guys coming back from China. And he put his airplane down, picked us up, and took us back to squared away.
Yeah, yeah, but he picked everybody up, and then you said you were the last one on the ground.
Yeah.
After he took off, I bet it got real lonely.
Oh, you talk about a hot pilot cooling off. I did cool off.
Sure.
I mean, I got scared. I thought the doggone guys would be running around there somewhere and find me, but... Of course, it wouldn't have made a difference if it was just me or all five of us. They would have got us. But
it's a little different when you're by yourself.
Yeah, that was a little different.
That's a different kind of pucker factor.
The whole
anybody to joke with.
The whole the whole attitude changed.
It's the minute that the last one's there and they take off, you're by yourself. You're like, well, this is a great idea.
When you can't hear that plane anymore and you really know you're alone.
Yeah.
But really, we had compared to Germany, we had it easy. Do you all realize? And that came out on the computer about I guess maybe 2 years ago when I saw it, when it came up on my computer, when I was searching for things. Did you realize that in Germany, or not in Germany, but in Europe, that 72% of the pilots and crews were killed?
Wow, that 72%? 72%.
Honest to God. I mean, that was horrific. Now, we weren't that bad, but we were bad at Sukhothing because of that bad accident. I mean, that was bad. Now, John Bullock from Henrietta, Texas is already dead and gone now, and so is B.T. Clark out of Chicago, the three of us that were left. So I'm kind of the last man standing.
Last man. Last man standing. Damn right. How old were they when they passed? Because y'all live forever.
John, no, Clark died around 4 years ago, and John Bullock died, I guess, maybe probably around 10, 12 years ago now. Yeah, he had a big ranch out there. His fat parents did.
The Bullock Ranch out yeah. Where out in Texas?
Pardon?
He's a Texas boy too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I met my wife on a blind date in Dallas.
Me too. Not in Dallas, though.
Yeah.
That was the best, right? Yeah. All right, keep going. So,
Let's hear about that.
Yeah.
Meet your wife?
Yeah, let's hear about that blind date.
Well, we were taking an instrument, additional instrument training off of Love Field. So they sent me down.
Wait, is this the start of a joke?
Yeah, they sent us from California to Love Field. And anyhow, we stayed in the YMCA. That's where we stayed, the pilots did that were taking the additional instrument training. And the guy sleeping next to me, he had a cousin, and she was taking lessons on how to plug, you know, lines into the telephone service, just like my wife was.
Switchboard operator?
Yes, long-distance operator. Anyhow, he says, Glorietta's a roommate of your wife, of a young lady. I didn't know her then, of course, of a young lady. And I'm going to take Glorietta out to dinner tonight, and Glorietta wants to bring the young lady with us if he could get somebody, some man, to go with him. So he says, how about you, Joe? What do you say? Come on. I said, on a blind date? I said, no way. I could just picture me getting a...
That's wingman material. Yeah. Say, hey, you need a wingman. Come on.
I don't know what to... No, I'm good.
But I finally caved in, okay? And we went out to... And I can still remember the house, the Dickey's house out in Highland Park. And we went into the living room. They invited us into the living room. The girls hadn't come out yet. I can remember them coming out the double door from the dining area somewhere. And Glorietta came out first, and I thought, oh, she's not too good looking. I hope the one that comes out next is better looking. Well, boy, she opened the door. My wife, she came out that door, and man, it took me 5 minutes to put my eyeballs back in.
All right, that's it. Watch out, my brother, steal your wallet. He's a politician. Yes, sir. Nice work.
Very nice work, sir. She's gorgeous.
Little Texan.
What was her name again?
Wanda.
Wanda.
Yeah, she's Wanda Park, actually, before she married me.
How long did you court her before?
Well, we went out together quite a bit there. Fortunately, I saved some money, and I kind of treated her to some places she hadn't been because she came from a poor family, and she enjoyed having the luxury. It wasn't that I had a bunch of money, but I spent all my money on her. And then we wrote to each other for a year and a half. And finally, when I was out in Tulare, California, flying the PT-13A, the first phase of flying and training, I asked her to marry me. And then when I got in the second phase, she came out and married me.
How long were y'all married?
68 years. She died. She'll be dead July 12th. She'll be gone 10 years.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry for your loss. 68, that's a wonderful marriage. That's a good number.
I never thought I'd live this long, honestly. I'm grateful. I'll tell you a lot of things about myself as far as health is concerned.
Come on with it. Tell, yeah.
I've never had a headache.
Wait, wait. All right. Well, then how are we going to take any of your other advice?
I never had a stomach ache, never broke an arm, never broke a leg, nothing. I just...
We shook hands when you came in, right?
Like I say, I attribute it all, everybody that asked me, I attribute it to two things.
Yes, well, yeah, tell them this.
That's eat bologna sandwiches for lunch every day. And then if the doctor tells you to do something, don't do it.
Don't do it.
Yeah, I've had a good life. I've had a real good life. I have wonderful children, three of them. I have two daughters and a son. My son lives out in Naples. My daughter, of course, lives here.
Yes, sir.
The older one, and then I live with my younger one. After my wife died, her husband was an attorney, and they had a big home up in, well, I'm pointing that way, it's not here. I'm thinking I'm in North Carolina. They had a big home up in the mountains. At Boone, North Carolina. My daughter decided, my wife went into Alzheimer's, and I was taking care of her by myself down in Wellington, Florida. And my younger daughter says, Dad, I've got plenty of room up here. We got they had 4,000 some odd square feet. And so they took the bottom part and made it into a two-bedroom apartment and two baths and dining room, living room, kitchen and all. She said, go ahead and sell your house and I'm going to put you up here and we're going to help take care of Mama. So that's where she died. And so I moved in with her, and then after she died, I just stayed with my daughter. And finally, I gave everything away. We had a lot of fine things in life. I had a good life. I wasn't any millionaire, but I was successful in life. I worked with banks, designing them back, putting them together. And I broke my story up now. I can't even think.
So when you got back, I have a quick question. When you got back, transitioning from the war back into civilian life, I got a ton of questions to ask you. Not even about the war. I'm talking about being a parent. What was your favorite decade of living? What would you go back and do? What am I doing wrong? Tell me.
I don't feel like I'm going to live.
Here's what happened.
You were talking about a coach, man. I got some questions. If you want to get into them, you got a phone number, I'll text you every day. Like, hey, I'm in this spot.
Yeah. When I came back, I asked to land in San Antonio, Texas, and the commander on the field came to me, and he says, "I understand you flew the hump." And I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "You got a lot of instrument time, haven't you?" I said, "Yes, sir. About 400 hours of instrument time." And he says, "Could you stay another year? I was going to, get out of service. I was going to divorce myself from service in San Antonio." He says to me, "Could you stay another year?" I says, "Well, yes, I could, but I don't particularly want to." He says, "Well, what we'd like for you to do is fly a C-47 hospital ship and carry the cripples to their various locations." Well, when he said that, I felt sorry for him.
Oh, yeah, I got you.
I said, "Okay, I'll stay another year."
That was a good officer. Get you like that.
That was a good thing to do, but it turned out bad from the standpoint that by the time I got out, everybody had jobs and they were all gone. So I had to go to work for a doggone shoe store. I worked for them for about 6 months before I finally found a company that came out of Detroit in Amarillo, Texas, had a branch out
there. So you sold women's shoes?
Women's shoes,
like Al Bundy, kind of like in a department store?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That's what I had to do. I had to make a living.
Hey, yeah.
That's what I'm talking about.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. And our children came along, of course, and what have you. And I finally found this company, and I made an application with them and went to work for them. I worked for them for Burroughs. It used to be Burroughs Corporation, which is now Unisys. And I I went ahead and worked for them for 19 years, and then a company out of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which had a big company there that would help put banks together and stuff. That's what hired me. I spent 25 years doing that.
19 with one company, and you said 29?
Pardon?
19 years with that one company, and then another one came in and got you?
Yeah, 25. Yeah, well, they made an offer I couldn't refuse. Oh, well, yeah.
So wait, you built banks?
I didn't construct banks. I designed. I designed layouts and also furnished, told them what to buy. You know, like you got to buy a vault door, you got to buy safety deposit boxes, drive ups, you got to have chairs, everything. And I got a little cut from everything. I mean, you know.
I bet you did.
I was busy.
team guy, good man. You designed the banks, huh? That's what I like to hear. All right, so, okay. So,
yeah, besides bologna sandwiches, okay, check. Wife, Melanie, y'all get together, bologna sandwiches.
What, like growing up, when you... I'm sorry.
Hold on, on the wife thing, what was coming home to her like from the war? What was your welcome home?
My welcome home?
Yeah.
Now, what was it like coming home to your wife after being gone to the war?
I when we landed in Casablanca, we were there for a week, of course, you know, trying to get a flight out. We flew over to Newfoundland, and then we flew into New York, and then we went into a compound where they checked us for dysentery and other stuff, you know. And I could call my wife, and that's the first time I called her. And I called her, and she was staying with her mother and dad. And when I called her, she fainted. So anyhow, what I did, she said, I'm going to come out to New York. I said, don't come, hon. Because I said, we're going to be 3 days in the infirmary. They're going to be checking us out for diseases because we had dysentery and all kinds of junk over there. And so I said, you just wait. I said, go to the Adolphus Hotel in Dallas because that's where I took her to a fine place with pheasant under glass to impress her. Anyhow, I said, just get a room and stay there. And I went ahead and I told her, I'd catch a train, and I'll go out to the train. She said, well, I'll meet you at the train. I said, it's impossible. I said, trains were all being sidetracked. You know, they were running all over the country. I said, you just wait there, and I'll get a taxi, and I'll meet you there. And that was a great day.
How long had it been since you'd seen her?
I arrived over there in, what did I say, July? June, yeah. It was right at the end of June when I arrived over there. I didn't get home till November of the following year. General Turner would not let us come home, period. He was the big commander all over the whole area. He wouldn't let us come. We didn't have no pilots, no replacement pilots. You see, you know how the government does. They make some good airs. What happened, we found out that we had an overflow of pilots, okay? When we first got into the war pretty good.
Yeah.
We had an overflow of pilots, so they decided to cut down on cadets. So they cut down on cadets, and then by that time, we really got into strong action, and we start losing. We start losing one after the other at our place and in Europe, too. And we couldn't come home. Of course, Europe would fly 35 missions on short missions, what we call into Germany. And the long-range missions into Romania and stuff, they'd go 45, pardon me, the other way around. 45 into the short missions and 35 into the long missions. And then they'd come home because it was, boy, the Germans just pounded the heck out of them.
So did you have anybody flying with you from World War One?
Did I ever?
Like any of the boys from World War One still around, I mean, fighting with you guys when you guys when y'all went in?
You know, I can't remember. I don't remember of anybody from World War One when I heard about it when I was, you know, going to school.
Yeah.
But Marcus, I can't remember.
Because there's some all of those guys
all
that...
I'm thankful to God that, you know, he gives me the memories that I have. I can remember things real well.
I was just marveling at that because I have trouble remembering what I did this morning.
Some of them guys can spit out the names, places, and towns that they were in and what time. And I was always fascinated how they could do that, too. You've been so many different places at so many times. It's hard to
keep up. Oh, I forgot to tell you about my experience. I skipped some stuff, and I'm going back now.
Oh, yeah, come on.
Colonel Cassidy calls me into his office. Joe, and Sheridan's coming in on a C-47. Going to entertain the troops. Go meet her, will you? He said, I don't want to meet her. Because he was chewing tobacco all the time, just running out of his mouth. So I said, okay, Colonel, I'll meet her. So I go to the landing strip, and here comes her airplane in.
Who is it again?
Ann Sheridan.
Ann, okay.
Looked like my wife from North Carolina.
Okay, yeah,
she's
yeah.
She's a movie star, a great movie star. Anyhow, I stand outside at the airplane at the ramp, and here she comes down the ramp, and I thought, well, what do I do now, you know? And she just walks right by me, didn't even know I was there. Well, anyhow, what happened, eyes and ears, I don't know if you all know about this, what eyes and ears of the world was at that time. It was a movie group, a filming group.
Okay.
Well, they were filming her, okay? They came over with the airplane, riding on the same airplane. They were filming her as she come off the ramp. And I was standing beside the ramp. So my picture got into the eyes and ears of the world. Now, this eyes and ears of the world was sent back to the United States. And when you went to a movie, before you saw the movie, you always saw the news, and the news was the eyes and ears of the world. So my wife and my sister, her sister-in-law, one night decided they'd go to the show in Amarillo. So they go to the movie house. And all of a sudden, my wife screams. Well, everybody ran, from the office. What happened? What's wrong? She said, I just saw my husband. And on eyes and ears of the world, greeting Ann Sheridan. So then Colonel Cassidy got into the act with eyes and ears of the world, and he made them sure that they know that I had rescued the Merrill Marauders. And I have a news clipping from Amarillo's paper. It's in our scrapbook.
Yeah.
I don't know if you. I don't think there's a copy of that in there.
Yeah, there's.
Yeah, some crazy things happened to me.
Keep going. So 100 years, and you, as soon as you were kind of, you turned into a man. So in our early 20s, we get sent to war. Then you go to war, you come back, then you set up, you have a great life. Through all of that, there's got to be some the valuable lessons. I mean, the short wisdom, the straight to the point. That's what I want to hear. If you give us any advice on everything that you've been through, from war to marriage to kids to grandkids. I mean, I met one of your grandkids. Yeah. So
I'd have to probably try to give you the same information I gave my grandson.
Now give me something better than you gave him.
Pardon?
I don't want what you gave him. I'll give you something better.
Well, the information I gave him, of course, was when you get a job, stay on the thing till you find another job, then leave it. Don't leave a job till you find a job. And so that's what I've been teaching my grandchildren. You know, it's not to be without job. Don't be without a paycheck. And I was also taught by my grandmother and grandfather, because they had tremendous integrity in the farming community, because they were real honest. I also learned... No, I was going to tell you, I was going to learn to slip my mind. So I get these short memories once they're knocked out.
No, you just have a lot of memories and a long time in them.
Yeah, 101 years.
That's completely different.
Probably got a lot going on in there.
When we lose those, that's a thing. There's so much in that mind of yours that's
what was it like?
I've seen so much. I'll tell you about my first car.
Let's hear about it.
I bought a Ford coupe with a rumble seat for $35.
What?
So the old man gave you? Did he give you a deal on your first car?
Yeah. Hey, talk about a little bit more like Henry Ford.
Let's go back to the you working at the Ford plant.
Oh.
Your first car was a Ford.
Yeah.
Did old man Ford hook you up with it? Because you couldn't much drive. You couldn't drive anything else into the Ford plant, right?
No, that's all we could drive. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
If you were working for Ford, you better drive a Ford.
Company man, company car.
Yeah.
Roger that.
You better drive a Ford. Yeah. Yeah, I bought a convertible, and I was kind of a backward boy, you know, coming off the farm. I didn't date till I guess I was 2 years out of high school. And I finally dated a girl in town. I thought she was pretty good looking, but I found out later that she had enough paint on her to paint the town red. But anyhow, my life was crazy with women. I mean, I just wasn't smart enough to.
What was it like in the 1930s and 40s as a young man? Because you were born in 21, yeah? No, 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, 21. What was it like growing up in the 40s and the 30s?
I mean, that's through the Depression, that's through the wars.
In the 30s, of course, I was on a farm totally at that time. I was still on a farm, and we found out that a lot of people in town, like in Detroit, you know, and we hear about it read it in the newspaper, we were standing in line for a cup of coffee, just a cup of coffee, and we felt sorry for them, and we couldn't sell all the products that we grew. Because we had a pretty good-sized farm. And what we couldn't sell on the market at that time, because it's hard to sell it on the market, they weren't buying there either. So what we do, we distribute what we sell, what we could on the market in Detroit, and then coming home, we'd stop off at different places where we knew families and different things, and we'd let them pick whatever they wanted out of the truck and just take it.
So back then, okay, so you paid $35 for a car. Let's break this one down.
And I was making 75 cents an hour.
75 cents an hour.
Yes, sir.
What would you say the greatest piece of technology that we have in 2021? I mean, growing up and seeing it, because that was before.
Now we have, like, the cell phone, right? What was the coolest thing you remember coming around? One, like an invention that was like, wow.
TV.
TV, okay. Yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah, when I first saw TV, that was something else. I couldn't imagine how that developed.
Did you guys have running water and electricity when you were a boy?
No, sir. Not at first. I was about a year from leaving the farm, you know, going to war, before we got water in. And then we also had inside privy. We had an outhouse.
Right.
And, you know, on Halloween night, we had a man named Mr. Hainer that had a farm next to us, had big apple orchard and grape orchard, and his grape orchard was adjacent to our farm. So Otto Kovacs across the street, another farm boy, and I would sneak over there into his grape field and get a bunch of grapes and eat them. So we were out there one time, and he come out there with a shotgun. He caught us. He scared the heck out of us. Well, we didn't pick no grapes after that. But when Halloween came, what we did, three of us boys, a Polish boy and Otto and myself, we went over at nighttime, Halloween night, and we moved his outhouse 4 feet back from the pit. I don't know whether he fell in it or not.
Yeah. Oh.
I've fallen in one of those before. I know how gnarly that is.
Oh, you talk about the trench, you know. We flew into, at Christmas Eve, we flew into Kunming. We landed, everything was fine. And all of a sudden, here comes yellow ball alert. And then come green ball alert. We knew they were getting closer, Bettys. We call them Bettys, they were twin engine bombers. That's all Japan had was twin engine bombers. And they were coming. So all of a sudden, red ball. When it was red ball, it's time to go to the trench. And you talk about the trench. I got in that daggum trench for the first time, you know, about not even as deep as this, about that wide. And here comes doggone Betty's dropping a whole bunch of anti-personnel bombs, small ones like pineapples. They had shrapnel around them. And when they hit, the shrapnel would fly all over creation. But when I'd look up, you know, I looked up and I thought to myself, these guys are coming, these bombers are coming. I'm looking up at the doggone sky. What am I protecting here? It scared me to death. I mean, I thought I'd drop a bomb in that damn place and we're done. But fortunately, the shrapnel didn't carry that far either. But the bad part was that about 10% of their bombs didn't go off. So they closed the airport down. You couldn't walk out. You had to stay right where you were. They warned us on loudspeakers till the guys would clean up, you know, clean up the ones that didn't explode. And man, it was a mess.
A lot of those places are still riddled with all that unexploded ordnance and stuff that went low order, even underwater.
Do you just want to wrap up and tell us, like, your greatest piece of advice, like, just in life, whether it has to do with your wife and love or just how to get through bad days?
Being around in the world for 100 years, it's changed a lot all over. If we could pass one piece of advice to the younger generation, like if my brother and I had to stand in front of a younger crowd and be like, "Hey, we got taught this by the guys that came before us."
Well, my theory in life, the only advice I can give you that I try to practice is, you know, if somebody's nasty to you, the heck with it. I walked off. I never got in a fist fight, never in my life. I just didn't feel like I needed to, because I always felt, I even taught my grandsons, you get in a fight and you get beat up, everything's fine, that guy's not going to hurt you anymore. But you beat the heck out of him, he may kill you next time. So I told him it wasn't worth it. And I said, just walk away from it. And I says, and I respect everybody for what they are, you know. I respect you for what you people did out there. I wouldn't go to Afghanistan. I'd hate to go there, okay? But what you guys did there, I respect you for it. I realize, too, that you couldn't win the war. You can't win that war there. I mean, it's crazy.
We weren't there to win a war. We just went there to whip their ass.
Yeah, it's a crazy place. A little different. But you guys did a good job. You did a fantastic, and I appreciate it. And I appreciate every man in Vietnam that was out in Vietnam, just like my son-in-law was. And I appreciate him. Not that I liked the war in Vietnam. I thought it was a political war. And I'm not trying to be, I don't get into politics. I don't like it.
You're 100 years old, you can say whatever you want.
Yeah.
You can literally say whatever you want. No one's going to, I mean, that's your right.
Anyhow, I don't like to see guys fighting and getting killed over what's kind of not worth it. To me, I felt like Afghanistan wasn't worth it. That's my personal opinion. If your opinion's different, fine, that's your opinion. And I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. And I agree with you that you were over there and took care of the best you could and the wonderful things you did, but I just... that's the way I feel. And I also, all my life, I always try to be friendly with everybody. You know, anybody. It didn't make a difference to me if it was a garbage collector or who it was. And I also told a garbage collector one time when he was picking up garbage in front of our house in Wake Forest in Raleigh, I told him how much I appreciate him. I said, I like the way you handle the garbage. I said, you pick, if you drop anything, you pick it up. And I says, you're a professional. I says, and I told him, you're as great a professional as anybody is in his field, you know. So he's a garbage collector. But if he does a good job, he's a professional. And that's the way I feel about people. And that's what makes me get along with a lot of people. I get along real good with people. I had a birthday party.
A bunch of them.
Yeah, but I had one. I don't know if this probably doesn't relate itself to this total. But anyhow, what happened on a Saturday morning at Lake Royal, we live on Lake Royal, at Lake Royal outside of Raleigh, And we live in a community where about 3,400 houses, and there are a lot of nice people in it, you know, a lot of older people, so retired. So my daughter, I could tell something was going on the week before. I mean, all the hubbub, you know, and all this stuff. So two of our friends down the street came with the little with the truck and picked me up and says, Joe, we ought to take you out to Gristmill. I says, why? He said, we want you to see it. It's a beautiful place, and you can buy cornbread and stuff like that there. I said, okay, let's go. So on the way out, the telephone keeps ringing, you know, his phone. And he's got it on speaker knocked down, you know, don't let nobody hear. And I thought, doggone thing, he talks for a minute, next time the phone rings again. I thought, boy, he's on a phone, what the devil is he doing? So we get to Gristmill, and it was beautiful. It was big rocks and stuff, and the water was going into the big wheel that was turning the mill and grinding. And they, I looked at everything. We walked through everything, went inside. I thought, well, now we'll go home. Well, they were walking around. I says, are we ready to go home? No, we'll stay for a while. Let's stay for a while. Well, he walks off. George, my friend, walked off, and he's on the phone again. Well, anyhow, about 15 minutes later, he comes. He said, we're ready to go home. So we head home. Well, the way our home is laid on our plot, it's on a slope and kind of a little hill out in the, where the front road goes by, around a corner. Anyhow, it slopes up and down. And we always come in here on this flat road, okay? Well, this time, we come all the way around, out of the way, to come up this hilltop, this slight rise. But I couldn't see across the rise. You can't see across the rise till you get up on top of it. Anyhow, I thought to myself, why is he going around that way? Well, we come across the rise. My God, there was cars all around. We have 3/4 acre, and they were all full of cars all around the edge. And I look out there, and they're all lined up with flags, waving flags. I'm the only World War II vet out there. So anyhow, then they start singing Happy Birthday. In Goldsboro, North Carolina, which is the biggest Air Force base now on the East Coast, a big bunch of pilots were there. The Carolina's North, the State College, the choir was there, and they sang me Happy Birthday separate, and they sang me the Air Corps song, you know, Off We Go. We had 40 tables set up out in our yard, and our porch, which is about maybe wider than that area there, was full of food. And we had friends from all over. I mean, we had about 250 people. It was the biggest party I ever saw. And then what they did, they took these pictures, and they took them to, I don't know where they took them, but they took pictures of me that I have in a scrapbook. My daughter took it out, of Mom, and I call her Mom. We all call each other Dad and Mom. My wife, they had a picture of my wife and I when we got married out in front of on the porch of the house we were renting at that time when I was in cadet training. And they made life-size on plaques. And they had a plaque made of me when I first entered cadets with the backpack on the parachute, and then another one when I got my commission in my wings, that one there, yeah. They're all life-size. They're right in front of the house. And I went over and looked at them. I dropped a few tears when I saw my wife, of course, but anyhow, I had the doggonest party you ever saw in my life. God, I never had anything like that in my life.
Well, you deserved it. Can't wait for see what this one's going to turn out to be like.
Now they cut a brick. They cut a brick. We have a flagstone, a big flag out front where you enter into our area. And that, down at the foot of it, they have nice rocks and stuff and concrete. And then one of the ladies that was a lieutenant in the Army, she had a brick cut for me, just a regular brick, and cut in there Joseph A. Bailo, Major Joseph A. Bailo, and World War II combat pilot. And they planted that under the flag out there at the entrance.
Have you been to D.C. to see the World War II? Have you done an honor flight?
No, I haven't.
Not yet?
Not yet. No, I'm planning. I'm kind of planning if I keep holding out.
I'm sorry. That was funny.
I'm going to go ahead and write the president and see if I can get a ride out there. If not, my one grandson said, whenever you're ready, Papa, I'll take you. Because it's only about, I'd say around 300 miles from our house.
No, from Carolina?
Oh, we'll help you get there.
We can get you out there.
Uh-huh.
You just say when you want to go.
Yeah, for sure. I think we know somebody who knows somebody.
You need to go see that.
Yeah, the World War II Memorial.
Yes, sir. Whole thing. The whole city is awesome.
I'd like to see it all. I'd like to see the vets, all this.
Yeah, it's all great. Y'all's, man, because they have, there's EWOs up. There's just so many. World War II, man. You want to talk about some getting after it.
Well, that's all. Hey, Joe, thanks for spending the afternoon with us.
Yes, sir.
Sharing some of your story with us.
I appreciate you.
Your life experiences.
I appreciate you.
Hope you have, going to have you back here at 101, 102,
103. Yeah. Every year, check in. I'm like, hey, this is what I need.
I'll come back. I come to see Jimmy's boy play baseball.
Well, don't come see Jimmy. You've seen Jimmy all the time. You come see us.
Yeah, we'll come out there and fetch you up.
For sure. Yeah, I always let him know when you're in town so we can come over.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate y'all.
Oh, really. Joe, thank you, buddy.
Yeah. No. I'll bet you were, because I was scared that one night, that one morning when I was there by myself only for 45 minutes or so. I'll bet you had a heck of a time being out alone like that. Where the heck did you hide?
Everywhere.
I mean, I thought there wasn't a tree out.
Remember, I was trained for that, too. So, that feeling right when you know you're alone. It's like, boom. If you've never been alone, and I'm not talking about just being by yourself. That's completely different. You know exactly what I mean. I just had that the whole time. But then I was on the move, and I was worried about dying, and then something else would always say, you know how it works, something always flows. It's the craziest scenario to be put in.
Yeah.
But it lends character, though, when we make it out.
Yeah.
I mean, I call it I started the Lone Survivor Foundation, but I also have a Lone Survivor Foundation. Like the base of me and everything is built around the fact that everything around me was taken away. And when you're alone, and it's it only takes a split second. It takes a snapshot in time to get that. It's almost like you go straight into it, and then while you're out there living it out, it's just that's the coming back part. And you know what I mean? So, thanks for everything you did. It's an honor to talk to you.
Well, I just did what I had to do.
That's what we all do.
Yeah.
So thank you for it.